There have been an amazing number of Olympic athletes with ties to Wisconsin, and we're going to be talking about some of them today. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest, Jessie Garcia. She's an award-winning television sportscaster, been covering Wisconsin athletes, Olympians since 1992, and is the author of three books, including her latest, Going for Wisconsin Gold, Stories of Our State Olympians. Which Wisconsin Olympian is your favorite? Do you have one from your home community or maybe a relative? Love to hear from you. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or go ahead and post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. And Jessie Garcia, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Larry. Pleasure to be here.
Oh, it's great. And, you know, I really enjoyed reading your book. You know, right from the start, the history of, you know, you've got a chapter or so on the history of the Olympics that I found fascinating. I didn't know that the Olympics had started and then there was a hiatus of about 1,300 years.
That's right. Well, thank you so much. First of all, I really appreciate those kind words. We wanted this book to also be a history of the Olympics so that as you read, you'd find out so much more about the Olympics and then how Wisconsin's history is intertwined with that history. So, yeah, you know, I said right away, let's start off with one chapter that just does a brief overview of how the Olympics came to be in the first place and then goes from there. And I think it's interesting, too. You know, when I started researching, I've been an Olympic junkie for a long time, but I never knew all of this about the history of the Olympics. And you're right. It did have a very long hiatus. And then the modern Olympics began in 1896, thanks to a Frenchman, Pierre de Coubertin, who had the idea of revival. And then our first Wisconsin Olympian was shortly thereafter in 1900.
Yeah, it was. It's wonderful. And then I look at the number of Olympians with Wisconsin ties, and to me that seemed like a large number.
Yeah, it's impressive.
And you talk a little bit about why you think that might be the case.
Well, so first of all, let me give you some hard numbers here. So we are actually up over 400. If you count in the 25 athletes and two alternates that we have coming up who will be competing starting next week or the end of this week in Rio, we are almost to 450 athletes from 1900 or 1896 all the way through these games. And that is really an impressive number. Now, to be connected to Wisconsin, you know, we decided early on that you would either be born here, you grew up here, you lived here, you worked here, you trained here. You know, Wisconsin is somehow connected to you and to your story.
And so that's how you decided really to which athletes to include in your book, I would guess.
Yeah, that's how we decided. And, you know, to go back to your previous question, too. So why does Wisconsin produce so many? I really think that our varied weather is a big bonus. You know, we have summer Olympians and we have winter Olympians of all kinds. And of course, our major universities. There are just a huge number of athletes that have come through the University of Wisconsin, Madison and the other UW schools and Marquette University and, you know, any other school that you could name. So one of the things that we did in researching this book was to go to every university that we could, to their archives, and find out, you know, who had been a part of their history that had competed in the Olympics. And that, you know, proved to be a really great database, a launching point for us. And then we just kept finding more and more and more and more. It just kept going.
Well, it was, you know, and what was fun for me as well was, it was fun to kind of review the achievements of each individual athlete, but I really enjoyed also what happened after the fact, because I didn't know in a lot of cases what happened to those folks.
Well, thanks. You know, one thing that we talked about very early on in this book, too, was we wanted each story to sort of be three separate parts woven together, if possible. You know, the first is the childhood. The second is the heart of the competition. And then the third is what happens afterwards. And I was really fascinated by that. You know, what happens when the spotlight goes off? And, you know, you probably aren't a superstar unless you're really just high, high echelon. But, you know, how is life like for an athlete then after that happens? That part has always fascinated me. So I really wanted to try to be sure to include as much as we could in these stories what happens. And I think that that's going to be an interesting part for people who read it, because it does emotionally, psychologically, and even physically, once you go from being an elite athlete to being quote unquote a sort of regular person, you know, it changes you in just a huge number of ways, even chemically and physiologically. And how do you go from, you know, training all the time to then trying to transition into sort of having this regular life and that type of thing. So, yeah, that is what I feel an important part of the story as well.
Let's go back to those games in Paris. They're, you know, this is way back. We had a Wisconsin track and field star. And I know, I'm trying to remember now, his coach was Mike Murphy.
Mm-hmm, and he was Alvin Krenzlein.
That's the one. Yeah, I couldn't remember his name. Sorry.
No problem.
But they introduced some changes to track and field that I think are still in use.
They are, indeed. I was blown away when I started researching this book and discovered this, because I couldn't believe that their names were not, you know, more in the forefront. You know, Alvin Krenzlein is known as the father of modern hurdling, and he pioneered the hurdling technique of putting one lead leg forward and your trailing leg behind you so you can go over a hurdle. Now, that is commonplace today. Everybody
sure.
does that. You can't really imagine it not like that. But believe it or not, prior to that, people would run up to a hurdle and they would hop with both legs tucked, you know, underneath their bottoms over the hurdle and then run to the next hurdle and repeat this very cumbersome process. And nobody had figured out hurdling until Alvin Krenzlein, who grew up on the east side of Milwaukee and went to the old East Side High School and then went to UW-Madison, you know, until he came along. And then his coach, Mike Murphy, you mentioned, was a very famous track coach at the time from the University of Pennsylvania. And he saw Alvin at the UW, and he lured him away, actually, about, you know, halfway through his time at the UW to Pennsylvania, to Penn. And he is known as the father of track, Mike Murphy is, because he invented crouching at the starting lines to get more acceleration from your legs. Before that, people would just stand at a starting line, and obviously you're going to get more acceleration if you're crouched. And he also invented rubbing liniment oil on your legs as sort of a crude, you know, early muscle rub. And he was one of the first people to look at athletes as being a whole human being with the need for superb nutrition and proper rest and everything else that we sort of take for granted now when we talk about athletes. So they're quite a duo. They really are.
And then back in the 30s, which was further ahead then from Mike, Ralph Metcalf was a star runner in the early 30s. And ran with Jesse Owens in Berlin in 1936, and that was an interesting experience that he had.
Yeah, absolutely. So between the two of them, they helped to shatter, you know, Hitler's idea of Aryan dominance. And Ralph Metcalf ran in one of the most famous relays, the 4x100, with Jesse Owens, where, you know, Americans won gold in front of Hitler. And Jesse Owens has said that Ralph Metcalf was actually a better runner than him, and that, you know, he doesn't know why he actually beat him more than Ralph beat him, because Ralph was an extremely powerful, explosive runner out of Marquette University. He was an Illinois native, but went to Marquette University. And he was involved in a couple of Olympic controversies that are detailed in the book as well. One has to do, actually, in the Olympics prior to that in 1932, has to do with a staggered start line being staggered wrong. They had measured poorly. And then in that 36 Olympics, I don't know if anybody's seen the movie Race, which was about Jesse Owens and came out some months ago, but they did talk about this. There was a big controversy about that relay that they were in, because they had originally two Jewish athletes were supposed to be the two last legs of that relay team, and Owens and Metcalf were not on that team. And at the last minute, the coaches replaced the two Jewish athletes with Owens and Metcalf. And the Jewish athletes wondered if it was because of their religion that maybe they were bowing to, you know, some of Hitler's, this was early, you know, for Hitler, but in some of his early demands. And they said, no, it's not that. It just, we're trying to get our best runners out there. But it became, you know, really a lifelong question. Some of these athletes the two Jewish athletes who were over there who didn't get to compete at all, they went all the way over to Berlin, and they did not get to compete because they were taken off the relay team. And, you know, lifelong, they were hurt by this.
Never forgot that, for sure. Well, you know, Metcalf, he had a very successful career following the Olympics. Is this the exception or is it the norm for Olympic athletes?
Oh, that's a good question. He did. He became a congressman from Illinois. He has a federal building, several schools in both Wisconsin and Illinois named after him, a scholarship, a neighborhood. I mean, he did some incredible things, longtime politician, and did a great things in politics in Illinois. You know, I don't know if I can say fully that it's the exception or the rule. Everybody's story is so unique and different. I will say that not all athletes, but some athletes, especially more in the modern times, do forego college or parts of college to train. And so when they come out then after the Olympics, they could be 5, 10, 15 years or whatever behind their peers in the workforce. So that has been an interesting part, too. Casey Fitzrandolph, in his chapter, I think, was really very honest about that aspect of it, because he had not finished college because he was focusing on training. And then suddenly your Olympic time is over, and he did win a gold medal. But he had to go into a career that he really had absolutely no training in and no experience in, and teach himself very quickly. So, you know, it is really interesting to see how everybody, where they go with it and what becomes of it.
You know, if I could not believe what I looked at in the book, you have a listing of the skaters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's speed like, skaters. Oh, this is a long, long list here. So we have a lot of Olympians with and so many medal winners with ties to our state.
Oh, we do. Yeah. So we have a couple of charts in there. I think you're talking, you're mentioning the speed skater one, which the Pettit Center provided us the information for, of every Olympic athlete that has come through Milwaukee for training. And that is the Pettit Center. And then prior to that, the old Wisconsin Olympic Oval, which was outdoors, but they trained and they trained in that for many years. I mean, that's where Dan Jansen, Bonnie Blair, you know, got their start. And then we also have a chart from the Milwaukee Admirals with all the hockey players that have from their, you know, their teams that have gone on, and not just to compete for Team USA either. I mean, many of these athletes might compete for a different country, their home country. And the Milwaukee Bucks provided us with the same information from all of the basketball players that have come through for them.
Carol in Green Bay has something for us. Hi, Carol. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I wanted to tell you about someone who wasn't actually an Olympic competitor, but she's my niece, and she is now 57 years old, and this year she ran her 25th consecutive Boston Marathon, and she also ran her 100th marathon. And she has been running since she was a little kid. She grew up on a farm between Reidsville and Brilliant with the 11 siblings. She saw the kids from the high school running past her place. She says, I can do that. And she started to run. And she has been running since. She's now grandmother of two, and she's still running.
Oh,
wow.
Well, that's a great story. And, you know, she was inspired by watching others run, her friends run. But I think probably many Olympians, and I'm sure you talk about this in the book at some point, were inspired by just watching. Before they ever got going, got inspired by watching other Olympians.
Sure, yeah. A number of the Olympians mentioned, well, specifically there are a lot of them who mentioned 1980, because that was the Miracle on Ice, and it was also Eric Heiden's year. And so a lot of our Wisconsin athletes were watching as children back then and were inspired by those games. You know, Casey Fitzrandolph comes to mind right away, and Garrett Weber-Gale, a swimmer who was in a very famous relay with Michael Phelps, you know, inspired by those games. So, or if it wasn't 1980, it was whatever Olympics, you know, they happened to be watching. So many of them were, you know, watching as children, or they were just inspired by their older brothers and sisters. You know, Dan Jansen was the youngest of a big number of kids, and his parents literally sent him along with his siblings and said, we don't have time. We don't have money for or time for a babysitter. Take Dan along. And they would take him out skating because they were involved in skating. And that's how he got started. So, and Susie Faber-Hamilton, you know, was running with her siblings up in the Stevens Point area on the trails back by their house, you know, just playing tag and looking for sticks and things. So, you know, that's a lot of it gets started that way, too.
Jessie Garcia, our guest today, have a lot of fun talking with her. Her latest book is called Going for Wisconsin Gold, Stories of Our State Olympians. And We'll be talking with her about more of the Olympians from Wisconsin. Hopefully you'll join in as well. Maybe you've got an experience to share about someone in your community who was an Olympian, perhaps. Call in 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or go ahead and post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Larry Mueller. Malik Anderson, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network. Coming up at 11:45 today, we'll talk to the author of a new cookbook about great bowls of food. Hope you can stay with us for that. Right now, talking with our guest Jesse Garcia, author of Going for Wisconsin Gold, Stories of Our State Olympians. And again, if you have a favorite Olympian or maybe you know a former Olympian, I hope you'll join in. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org. Or go ahead and post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You know, that you mentioned Eric Heiden, and what he accomplished in 1980 in Lake Placid was almost unimaginable today. In fact, I don't think it'll ever be broken. Do you talk about what he was able to do?
Yeah, no, it will never be broken because athletes specialize in so many, you know, different distances now. But, you know, Eric Heiden winning 5 gold medals in every distance, short to long, that he competed in was just amazing. I mean, it's really the equivalent of if you looked at a sprinter today on in track, if they won the 100-meter dash and they won the 10,000 meters, you know, which would never happen because you train in one distance or another. And Eric Heiden just happened to have this this body type. He says in the book that his coach just told him, you know, you're one of these unique guys who can do, one of the only ones who can do a short distance or who can do a long distance. He was sort of a middle distance guy that could go swing either way. And, you know, in that one year, he caught lightning in a bottle. But Eric Heiden is also one of the most humble athletes I have ever encountered. And, you know, even back then, he was calling the whole thing the big whoopee. He was saying, people want to interview me and ask me all these questions, but I'm only 21 years old. What can I tell anybody?
I thought that was a great quote in your book. And you also mentioned that he said he was glad for the miracle on ice because that took away some of the pressure on him.
He was, yeah. He was friends with Mark Johnson and Bob Suter, two of the hockey players from Madison who were on the Miracle on Ice 1980 team, and he actually went to see the game against Russia, the famous game. And so, you know, he was really happy to have the spotlight sort of diverted off of him because he was not comfortable in the spotlight. You know, he was just an athlete who was out there, you know, doing his thing, and he happened to be better than everybody else in the world at every distance. And he even ran or skated one of those races on nothing but about a piece of bread for breakfast because he'd overslept and was racing to the track and just ate a piece of bread on the way there.
That was amazing. Just an amazing guy. And then has had a wonderful career as a surgeon.
Yeah. He has gone on to be an orthopedic surgeon and lives in Utah now and is the team orthopedist for U.S. speed skating at different Olympics. So he's still involved in speed skating. And, you know, his father was an orthopedic surgeon as well. And so he always saw that and he wanted to follow in his father's footsteps. And, you know, he had a quote in the book, too, and I'm not quoting him exactly here, but, you know, he said something to the effect of, you know, athletes need to move on. You know, athletics can only take you so far. And I knew that, and I needed to move on to a whole different part of my life that I was interested in as well.
Let's turn to Dan in Madison next. Dan, hi. Thank you for calling.
Oh, my pleasure. Pleasure to talk with you. Not necessarily Wisconsin athletes, but I had the pleasure of working with an office manager recently whose dad, Hispanic, went to the 1936 Olympics, and so the story goes, knew Jesse Owens well, and they were both excluded from the Olympic Village, presumably because of race. And I'm wondering if you know anything about that or have heard anything about that.
You know, I have not heard about the exclusion in that particular Olympics because of race. It is certainly quite possible. I wouldn't doubt that it happened. But it was not a big part of... So, for instance, I interviewed Ralph Metcalf Jr. In Chicago. He lives in Chicago. And in talking with him, that was not a big part of anything that he brought up. At the time, what I have read and what I've heard is that racial tensions were high when they got over to Germany for the Olympics. But it was also because Hitler was just coming into really the axis of power. There was not the oppression of athletes because of, or anybody because of race as much as there was going to be. So it was really just like tension was rippling in the air. When they walked into the stadium, for instance, there was booing, the European booing, the European version of booing going on. And so they, you know, they felt very awkward, and they knew that they were there for a bigger picture than just sports, but they also just really tried to focus on their races and the fact that, hey, if we win because we're the best athlete, and we're here to try to win a medal, and we're not here to try to change the world. Of course, we did discover later in the course of history how important that was, you know, for their races, and how much that has stood the test of time, and, you know, how it really did, you know, shatter some of Hitler's ideals that German athletes were going to just dominate the world.
Thanks again, Dan, for calling. Keith in Door County will turn to you next. Hi, Keith.
Hi, thanks for having me on. I used to wrestle for the University of Wisconsin, and in 1980, I was at the Olympic training camp for Greco-Roman. So we had, earlier that year was the first year that we ever had beaten the Russians in the World Cup. We beat them 6-4 with a freestyle wrestling team. And in the 1980 Olympic camp, when we were there, that's when we found out that the games are going to be boycotted. But we had, I believe it was 5 members of that Olympic freestyle team that were all from Wisconsin. Our coach, Russ Hellickson, Andy Ryan, Lawrence Soucy, Ben Peterson, Lee Kemp, I think there might have been 6, and Jim Haynes. But, of course, the team never made it over there because of the boycott. But I just wanted to bring that up as well.
I know every one of those names is quite familiar to me. Jesse, comment?
Absolutely, and those names are familiar to me as well. And the boycott was, very sad for all the athletes who wanted to go over and were able to go over at that time. Eric Heiden was really outspoken against the boycott, you know, right after the right after 1980. So he talked about that immediately afterwards when they went to the White House to visit Jimmy Carter, and he said, "I really hope we don't boycott." Well, in fact, they boycott.
Did.
Yeah, and so looking back in history, boy, it sure would have been nice if they, you know, could have gone to those games. And I will have to ask your caller if we ever do an update to this book. I would love to include a chapter in there about the athletes who, you know, were excluded from perhaps their only Olympic games because of the decision of the president not to go. So. Tell him that I'll have to check back with him on that.
Thank you, Keith. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Darren in Milwaukee up next. Hi, Darren.
Hey, great topic. It's just it's exciting as we're getting ramped up the Olympics to think about the local athletes. But I've got a real good friend of mine that participated in the Olympics and was with the Eric Heiden era. And, I just think, you know, for him, it was, you know, you just the things that stand out was just the incredible training regimen that these guys went through. He would talk about taking an inner tube of buckshot and doing these duck walks up the hill by the water tower on the east side. And, it's just intense. And the thing that that stands out with me was he went on from that, and he's got a really successful Italian restaurant in River West. He's a real community leader. It's called Centrals. I want to throw a kitchen for it, but it's just I just think that idea of that Olympic effort that was applied, he was able to carry that over in his own entrepreneurship.
I think that's an interesting point. Well, first of all, the training part. I mean, I don't think people realize how much training actually goes into this. Yeah, of course, you know, Olympians train. But, you know, we're talking, you know, for some of them, 4 a.m. every day, followed by maybe a couple hours of sleep, followed by another long workout, and then another rest, and then a workout into the evening. Year-round training. I mean, speed skaters are on bikes, you know, in the summer doing their summer training and running up hills. And, you know, it is really, really impressive, the amount of training that goes into it. And then, yeah, a number of them are able to turn, you know, their success into something more entrepreneurial as well. You know, I'm thinking of Bob Suter from Madison. I mentioned him earlier on the 1980 Miracle on Ice team, and he started Suter's Gold Medal Sports in Madison, and also worked with youth hockey forever. And Mark Johnson, of course, is now the coach of the UW women's hockey team. A number of people stay in their sport in some way, shape, or form, you know, whether it, or give back to their sport, even as like an Eric Heiden has done. Garrett Weber-Gale went on to start a, it's called Athletic Foodie, you know, doing food and nutrition for athletes, you know, after his Olympic time was over. So everybody sort of finds their way. But some people also just, when they're done, and they move on to completely new careers, too, which also fascinates me.
You know, I was thinking, as you were talking about the amount of effort, Bonnie Blair stands to mind. I mean, she lost in her first Olympics, if I remember your chapter.
Yep.
But then, like, she spent the next 4 years, didn't she, doing pretty much nothing but getting ready for the next Olympics?
Yeah, training for the next Olympics. And, you know, living out of, so her family was in Illinois, and she moved up to live with some family friends here in Elm Grove so that she could be closer to the, you know, outdoor Wisconsin Oval. So, you know, it is pretty incredible the sacrifices that the families make and the sacrifices that the athletes make. I mean, Bonnie Blair has joked that, you know, they never went on a family vacation. She doesn't remember a family vacation, because on their weekends or their free time, they were driving to another speed skating race, you know, somewhere in the country. So the sacrifice that goes in from the parents, I mean, honestly, the medals are not just as much, but they are at least a little bit belonging to the parents as the kids. And we did put in one little section called A Mother's Perspective, because I, as a mother myself, I was sort of interested in that aspect as well. And we asked Mary Antoine, the mother of Matt Antoine, who won a bronze medal in skeleton in 2014, to you know, be interviewed by me, which she was gracious enough to do, and to talk about what it was like to see your own child then win a medal, and all the sacrifices that go into it.
Jerry in Waukesha, thanks for calling. Hello.
Hi, thanks for letting me participate. 1980 Olympics was pretty special for myself and my circle of friends, because we all grew up hockey fans as kids. So I was, first of all, lucky enough to watch Mark Johnson and Bob Suter play out in Madison a couple times when we went to games, but also here in Milwaukee, we naturally followed the Milwaukee Admirals. And there was a player on the team that played for Milwaukee for a couple of seasons before getting back. I think they played to stay in shape, because he was here from like 77 through 79. And his name was Bud Snyder. And in those days, when Admiral games were over at night, if they weren't leaving town right away to hit to another town, usually I went to one of the local taverns across the road. So we were lucky enough to get kind of a casual relationship with Bud Snyder, sitting drinking some beer with him once in a while. And also there were a few players on competing opposing teams in the IHL. One of them played for Toledo. His name was Mike Ruzioni, the guy that scored the game-winning goal against the Russians. So we used to heckle the daylights out of him for a couple seasons. But one other thing that was neat was, if you watch the movie Miracle, they show that the IHL All-Star game from that year, instead of the teams playing All-Stars from each other, they formed one team, and they played the Olympic team. It was only a couple weeks before they left for the Olympics. So we were lucky we attended that, and I still got the program for that. Unfortunately, I don't have the page ahead to all the players on it anymore, because we used to take that out of the program and fold it up small so we could quick look at the numbers and see who we wanted to heckle by name.
That's funny.
That's a good story. I just tell one quick one on the night of the day of the game, the Miracle on Ice game. I was going to visit a friend, and I it was a 3-4 hour drive almost, and I drove the whole time with the radio off because I didn't want to hear the final result because, of course, it wasn't aired live.
Right. Yeah. It was tape delayed. Were you successful in that then? You were able to keep the secret?
Absolutely. I went right to that. I went right to her house, and we sat and watched the game and really enjoyed the excitement of it.
Yeah, yeah. The Miracle on Ice, I think it just still gives everybody goosebumps. I know it does for me. The movie Miracle, I just loved. When I was watching old YouTube videos and listening to old radio calls of the Miracle on Ice to write that chapter, every single time I would just get tears in my eyes. It really was so special, this ragtag group of college kids that gave the United States a huge boost at a time when there was a lot of uncertainty going on as well. There were some political situations happening in the world. There were economic problems for a lot of families, and people kind of needed something good to happen, and certainly nobody expected this group of college kids playing against the mighty Russians to do much of anything at all. They were thinking they'd lucky to get silver when they went in, if that. And then of course what they had to do here. But remember, that Russian game was the semifinal,
right?
And I think people forget that. They had to go on and win gold, which of course they did.
We've talked a little bit about some of the women Olympians, but you have a nice chapter on Karen Bai that I enjoyed reading.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. Pronounced Karen Bai, but I know it
Karen
looks like
Bai.
Karen.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Karen Bai, it was on the first women's Olympic hockey team. So, here we had the Miracle on Ice. And she's one of the people, too, who was inspired by watching the Miracle on Ice. But in 1998, they brought forth the first women's team, and she was on that team, and they won gold. And her story was really inspirational to me because she had to start off as a child up in northwest part of Wisconsin, and she would pretend that she was a boy in order to be on the hockey teams that she was on. So she would have her initials in the program would be KL Bai, which stood for Karen Lynn Bai, but she didn't want anybody to know that. Tuck her hair up under and skate with the boys because it was not accepted at the time at all. Well, these days, of course, we have girls hockey teams all over the state, and girls hockey teams on college teams as well. And it's not a surprise at all to see a young girl with a ponytail and a hockey bag over her shoulder. And Karen was part of that generation that changed that.
Mike in Madison, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Thanks, Larry. I guess keeping in the hockey theme, Madison used to have a dozen or two dozen small makeshift rinks around the city parks. And one of those rinks on the far east side, before it jumped the interstate, a young kid who lived about a block away, I used to skate with him out there. His name was Mark Barron. And as in back in the days, just showed up at the park with your Christian stick, and kids got together by throwing their sticks in the middle, and everybody had get up on a separate team, and Mark was one of the players out there, and he ended up going to UW.
Mm-hmm. It's a great player here.
NCAA championship, yep. And then he played for the U.S. team in the Olympics at Sarajevo in 1984.
Wow. You will read a lot in this book, actually, about those little local ponds and hockey rinks. Mentioned in the Eric Heiden chapter and the Mark Johnson-Bob Suter chapter, and also Connie Carpenter-Finney, who went to the Olympics in speed skating and then also went back in cycling. And she got her start on the east side of Madison playing pom-pom, on the big the big open ice with a bunch of friends, and just got so good so fast. And Chris Whitty from West Africa is sort of a similar story as well, just skating for fun, and then different coaches from the local speed skating team started to notice them and say, hey, you're pretty good. how would you like to join the team? But they have such fond memories of skating on those outdoor ponds, everybody that I talk to.
And thanks again for calling, Mike. Appreciate it. You've all those athletes that you write about that are certainly inspiring stories. Do you have one that particularly touched you?
Oh, that is such a hard question because, honestly, each chapter is like your baby. But, you know, I think I'd have to go back to Alvin Krenn's line, or, you know, the man who invented hurdling, only because to me it was it just blew me away so much when I read about him. And, you know, he's quite an interesting story. And there's a controversy, an Olympic controversy that involves religion that is in his chapter as well. I won't give it all away. Have people read the book. But, you know, he was involved in one of the very first Olympic controversies. And I wanted to mention that I was able to track down Alvin's granddaughter, and she has never been to the state of Wisconsin because he had been lured away to Pennsylvania. She grew up there, but she's coming back. Actually, tomorrow we pick her up at the airport, and she's coming in for both of our book launches this week. Tomorrow night at the Madison Public Library at 7 p.m., and Thursday night at the Pewaukee Public Library at 6:30 p.m., and then we have another one next week, August 10th, Wednesday, at the Shorewood Public Library. But she will be here to see Wisconsin for the very first time. I'm going to show her Milwaukee. I'm going to show her Madison. And she's going to bring Olympic memorabilia and talk about her grandfather's accomplishments. And along that same realm, we have the grandson and great-grandson of Oscar Osthoff, who will be there, of the Osthoff Resort fame in Elkhart Lake. Oscar Osthoff's parents started the Osthoff Resort, and he was an Olympic weightlifter in 1904 after being a bellboy at the Osthoff Resort. So they're coming. In addition, Bonnie Blair will be at both events, Casey Fitz-Randolph, several curlers, Mike Poplinski, Debbie McCormick. I mean, we are really, really excited for these book launch events because not only will people get to hear these stories and get to hear me talk a little bit about the book, but they're going to get to meet all these Olympians and see some of their medals and their memorabilia and get autographs and books as well.
Now, go back over those dates and places again.
Sure. So our first book launch is tomorrow night, Tuesday, August 2nd, and that will be at the Madison Public Library, downtown Main Branch, and it begins at 7 p.m. It's a part of the Wisconsin Book Festival. And then our next event will be Thursday, August 4th, at the Pewaukee Public Library, and that starts at 6:30 p.m. And then our final event is next Wednesday, August 10th, and that's at the Shorewood Public Library, just north of Milwaukee. And for all of these events, we are just so excited to, you know, I have a program with different videos. I have a video, for instance, of the race in the Hitler Olympics with Jesse Owens and Ralph Metcalf that we're going to show. And I'm going to go over several others. Dan Jansen is sending a video along of himself greeting everybody because he can't make the event. But we have just a big number of Olympians that will be there. And it's going to be an Olympic celebration and just in time for Rio, which kicks off Friday night.
This is really one. I really enjoyed your book. You know what? Just as an aside, I really like the right at the end. You give us a paragraph or a couple paragraphs on how you researched each chapter, and I was glad to see that.
Oh, well, thank you. We thought that was important, you know, so that people could see. We consulted a huge number of sources and tried to interview the people or their descendants in most cases, you know, if we could. And then, you know, I had a stack of probably 30 Olympic history books next to my bed for, you know, for months. And I would just pour through these Olympic history books, you know, every day and every night, and was completely immersed in this as I was writing it.
Well, I'll tell you what, it's been a real joy talking with you. I have to say, we've just touched the surface of your book. There's so many other great stories in the book that people are going to really enjoy reading about. Jesse, thank you so much.
Thank you, Larry. Really enjoyed it.
Jesse Garcia is the author of Going for Wisconsin Gold, Stories of Our State Olympians, a really fascinating book. I learned about the history of Olympics that I didn't know, and then to learn, to sort of review what happened to some of the athletes I remembered, of course, and then to see what happened to them after the fact was really made for a great book all the way around. So we have a link on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, so if you want to go to that, you're going to get some more information about the upcoming events. August 2nd, August 4th, August 10th. There's another one, August 29th in Wausau. I don't believe she might have mentioned it, but I'm not sure she did. Anyway, you can get all that information on our website. Well, coming up, we're going to switch gears and talk with you a little bit about food. Have you been to a restaurant recently that has food bowls on their menus? It may be called a Buddha bowl, a Zen bowl, a gratitude bowl. I had a burrito bowl in a Madison restaurant over the weekend and really enjoyed it. And our guest coming up next, Robin Asbell, is cookbook writer and chef. She's been with us before. She teaches cooking classes around the country. So we'll talk about her latest book, Great Bowls of Food. Great bowls, Buddha bowls, broth bowls, and more. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.